Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the latest in the OIES podcast series. This is the fourth podcast we're doing on the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on energy markets. And this week we're back to the topic of gas. And I've got with me three colleagues from the Institute, Jack Sharples, Mike Fullwood and Agnieszka Asson. And we're going to be talking today about Russian gas flows and why they are perhaps not as high as they might be. We're going to talk some more about prices and price differentials. And then finally, we're going to get on to the latest on the EU advice around ruble payments for Russian gas. But let's start with you, Jack, if we may. There's obviously been a lot of talk over the last couple of weeks about what the impact of a European embargo on Russian gas imports or just a Russian gas shutoff would mean for Europe. But actually, flows have been continuing and, if anything, have actually increased since the start of the war. Can you give us an update on what's happening with flows at the moment and some of the kind of overall conclusions?
Well, the immediate reaction to the launch of the Russian invasion of Ukraine was that the flow of Russian gas into Europe did indeed increase quite strongly, and it remained relatively strong compared to January and February throughout March. But interestingly, what we've seen over the last 3 weeks is that those flows have gradually declined. And actually, the most recent data that we have, Friday the 22nd of April, saw the flow of Russian gas to Europe, excluding Turkey, reached 245 million cubic meters per day, which is a substantial decrease on the 400 million cubic meters per day we saw this time last year. So clearly the flow has dropped away a little bit. In terms of how that's being delivered to Europe, the Nord Stream pipeline remains full, but the Yamal Europe pipeline via Belarus and Poland to Germany is continuing, as it has done for weeks now, in a situation of not delivering gas onward to the German market. Gazprom seems to be continuing to use Turkish Stream for its deliveries to Southeast Europe at its full capacity. But again, as the total flow of Russian gas into Europe has dropped off over the last couple of weeks, so we have seen a decline in flows via Ukraine.
So thanks very much for your prompt on the date, actually. Yes, I always forget to do that. So we are recording this podcast on the 25th of April. So any prices we talk about and flows we talk about are relevant to that date. So tell me, Jack, you've reminded us that although flows are up on January and February, they're down significantly year on year. What's going on there? Because our buyers have the right to nominate for the flows they want under their contracts, obviously. So why are we down so much? Why are buyers not nominating for more gas from Gazprom?
Well, I think there are two things going on here. Firstly, is that Gazprom has effectively withdrawn from the European spot market. We already saw that their sales on the electronic sales platform throughout last year declined and then ceased entirely on the 13th of October. But the more recent developments that we've seen, where Gazprom has divested its interests from Gazprom Germania and some of its trading subsidiaries in Europe, leads us to believe that Gazprom is simply not active to any great extent or even at all at the moment on the European spot market. So that accounts for a chunk of the gas that we're not seeing at present compared to last year. But you're absolutely right that there are many European gas buyers that hold long-term contracts with Gazprom that do have flexibility within the bounds of those contracts to raise or decrease their daily nominations. Now, one of the things that we think is happening at the moment is that the balance between the prices in those contracts and the day-ahead spot price at European trading hubs is influencing those companies to either raise or lower their nominations under the long-term contract. And at a time when the long-term contract prices are at a premium, then they will lower their long-term contract offtake and buy instead on the hubs. Now, in terms of how this has played out in recent weeks, clearly when the invasion began, day-ahead hub prices skyrocketed, which put them at a significant premium to the long-term contract prices. So that explained the increased offtake under those long-term contracts. As that differential has settled down, and indeed it seems that moving into April, in fact, the long-term contract prices move to a premium because they are based to a significant extent on the front month traded contracts, particularly in the TTF, and they were reflecting some of the jumpiness, if you like, some of the fear in the market that occurred around the invasion in late February and into March. So as the long-term contract prices moved to a premium, it looks like Gazprom's counterparties were lowering their nominations and turning back again to spot purchases.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, Mike, I'll come to you in a minute, but Mike Forward produced a paper recently suggesting that actually it'd be beneficial for European customers if actually there were increased nominations to increase supply into the European market under the long-term contracts. So is there not an economic incentive here to increase nominations, or what's holding everyone back?
Well, there is a collective economic incentive that if all holders of long-term contracts were to act the same way and were to all raise their nominations at the same time, that would indeed effectively force more Russian pipeline supply into the market and hopefully bring prices down. But of course, there is a problem of being the first mover. If you're the first company to raise your nominations, then you will effectively be off-taking more at a relatively high price compared to some of your competitors. There is also a free rider problem that even if a collective number of companies were to start increasing their nominations in the hope of bringing prices down, then there are always those that are tempted to free ride off that. And then finally, I think there is undoubtedly a political element here, which is under which any sort of encouragement of greater offtake of Russian gas is politically somewhat toxic at the present time, given the emphasis on decreasing European imports of Russian gas and searching instead for alternative supplies.
And so does this have any implications then? I mean, you've got buyers nominating at various levels on commercial basis. Does this have any implications for the flows via the different routes from Russia? What are we seeing with the different corridors?
Well, I think a really interesting, slightly longer term issue here is that, yes, we're seeing the European buyers of Russian long-term contract gas lifting and lowering their nominations on a day-to-day basis, really just to make use of the sometimes small, sometimes more substantial differentials between the contract and prompt hub prices. But I think in the longer term, over the next couple of years, what we're seeing is a very strong political drive to reduce imports of Russian gas. So where previously we would have thought that Gazprom's grand plan, if you like, was to make use of Nord Stream 2 to reduce its dependence on gas transit via Ukraine in a context of substantial Russian supply to Europe, now we are seeing a situation where demand for Russian gas is declining, primarily politically driven. And so even without Nord Stream 2, Gazprom has the possibility to, over the next couple of years, perhaps reduce its dependence on Ukrainian transit, perhaps in time for when their long-term transit contract expires at the end of 2024. So it puts a rather different gloss on things for the next couple of years.
And are we seeing evidence of that now? I mean, can you see that in the volumes now? Can you see the kind of northern and southern corridors being emphasised by Gazprom and the central corridor via Ukraine being diminished?
Yes, we can. So there are two very good examples of this. So firstly, we've seen in the south the use of Turkish Stream to supply markets that were previously supplied via Ukraine. The most recent addition to that being Gazprom's supplies to Hungary from the 1st of October last year. Then moving further north, what's very interesting is to see the flow of gas from north to south, from Germany into Austria and from Germany and the Czech Republic into Slovakia. Now, Slovakia and Austria, and they flow gas onwards to Italy as well through a sort of a central corridor. They are markets that traditionally receive their gas via Ukraine. The fact that they're receiving gas physical flow volumes from Germany to the north suggests that some of that at least is Russian gas that's arriving in Germany via Nord Stream and then being delivered onwards to Central Europe, and in effect already squeezing transit that was previously occurring via Ukraine.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks, Jack. So, Mike, let me come to you now. So we're seeing this variability in flows under contracts and buyers turning to the spot market. What's happening with LNG flows? Is that as variable, or are we seeing some consistency there?
Well, I think, thanks, Jim. I think there has been a bit of consistency in the first 4 months this year with a lot of LNG flowing to Europe. Seems to have continued pretty much in April. So I think by the end of April, the sort of wider Europe, including UK and Turkey, is going to be about 17 billion cubic metres higher than the previous year in 2021. And that's in part that's been facilitated by increased supply, especially from the US, a pattern which we expect to continue through the year, especially as some of the constraints we had in 2021 from plants begin to unwind. In Asia, it's been a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, the most surprising thing, I think, is that China imports are down probably around about 8 BCM year on year in the first 4 months. Japan, Korea, Taiwan sort of down a very small amount, sort of holding up. Southeast Asia, as the emerging markets, has shown actually some growth in the first 4 months of this year. But India, Pakistan, Bangladesh are down on pricing. And obviously, you know, Brazil, South America is down as well because it's been raining. So it's been a bit of a mixed bag. So the flows into Europe have been facilitated by weaker demand in other markets. I think China really is the uncertainty now. Reports in the press this morning that some Chinese buyers of LNG are looking to offload cargoes into the spot market in the summer because of the fear of further lockdowns impacting economic activity.
Okay, interesting. So actually, that would suggest that there's a reasonable amount of LNG supply in the market. We still have Russian gas flowing, albeit at lower levels. That would suggest to me that, you know, the market's pretty fully supplied, but prices still pretty high. How do we explain what's going on with prices at the moment?
That's a good question. I think there's still quite a bit of fear premium in the market that Russia flows will be curtailed, either because issues on ruble payments or because the EU eventually decides to try and sanction Russian gas. I think that's still quite unlikely. There's still a lot of division of opinion in the EU on that. But there's a big fear that Russia flows will get curtailed. I think if they don't, and we get through, and I know Agnieszka's going to talk about this in a minute, we get through the ruble payment issue and flows continue, I guess, roughly at the sort of the take-or-pay levels, then potentially the market looks reasonably well supplied through the summer. And actually, Jack didn't talk about storage, but the EU target may be relatively easily achievable if Russia flows are maintained at contract levels. And that's obviously the big if.
Okay, well, I'm going to come back to Jack on for his regular storage update in a minute. But before we go there, I wanted to talk about a couple of kind of price anomalies that we've got. So we've got TTF at around 90 euros per megawatt hour. But I noticed that, you know, the NBP price is significantly lower than that, down at around 60. What explains that differential?
I think that sort of came off in the last 10 days. There's a big differential opened up between NBP and TTF. And I think it's a consequence of the LNG coming into the UK market and then, in effect, more molecules going down the interconnector from BBL to Europe. And that's been running pretty full. So the UK market, as National Grid often says, is sort of oversupplied with gas because you can't now, it's limited the amount you can evacuate down the interconnectors. So when that happens, you know, prices tend to fall relative to the to where they're trying to export the gas to. I think that explains that. But, you know, given the LNG coming into the market and with Norwegian flows are maintained, then the UK market could be relatively well supplied for the whole summer if these trends continue.
Okay, so then let's talk about the differential between summer and winter prices then. I mean, if that's right, I presume summer prices could fall and we could start to see some kind of differential open up. But tell us what the situation is now. I don't think there's much of a differential now, is there? But what hope is there of that opening up in the future?
Well, it looks really flat. I mean, there's almost no differential at the moment in the summer, the coming summer and the next winter spread. But I think at some point, I mean, the incentive to invest, to inject into storage comes from two things. One is you have to put so much in storage because your government or the EU is telling you you need to do that to bring gas in. But also that as storage fills up, there's an incentive on the part of traders and other buyers to put gas into storage in the summer and take it out in the winter. So you need a differential to do that. A differential open in one of two ways. Either the summer prices can come down below the sort of 90 euros you talked about, Jim, or the winter prices can go up. You know, going back to the point I was making about the LNG continuing to come into Europe, and if Russia flows maintained at contract levels, you might expect the summer price to be weaker, thereby opening up a differential to winter, when actually there could be a lot more risk of disruption to flows. So I think that may need to happen for the EU to achieve its sort of target. But a lot of it would be achieved by, in effect, you know, you're regulated to put this amount of gas into storage.
Okay, Jack, let me come back to you briefly, if I may, as we talk about storage. Can you give us your kind of regular update on where we are with stocks in Europe and what the sort of direction of travel is?
Yeah, so again, as of the 22nd of April, we have 32 BCM roughly in European storage. So it's about 31% full. So with the European Commission target of reaching 80% full by the 1st of November, we are left needing to inject around 50 BCM this summer over a period of 6 months between May and October. So just over 8 BCM a month. Now that doesn't really look very different from the pattern of injection last summer. But of course, the difference is that we are starting the injection season with very firm prices, to put it mildly. And as Mike has just illustrated, there remains significant uncertainty really as to what the summer-winter spread is going to be, and so therefore how strong the commercial motivations to inject will be. So that will be a major challenge. And again, also, as Mike said, there is also a physical supply issue, whereby if the physical supply continues to be available, then that will help with the storage. But equally, if we do see any kind of disruption or curtailment of Russian flows in a physical sense, then that will make the storage injection task so much the harder.
So thanks, Jack, for that. And Jeske, let me come to you now. I guess the key question looking forward then, and the key reason for prices being high in the summer, is obviously the concern that there will be a cutoff of Russian gas exports to Europe. And I guess one of the possible catalysts for that, as we've discussed before, is this demand from the Kremlin that Russian gas exports be paid for in rubles. Now, you gave us your view on how that related to the current long-term contracts. But now, finally, as of last Friday, the 22nd of April, we have an advisory document from the European Commission, which was sent to the member states. Can you give us a quick sort of roundup of the key messages from that document, please?
Sure. It's a very short document with three main messages. The first is that the decree signed by President Putin on the 31st of March substantially amends the legal framework for the execution of Russian gas supply contracts with EU buyers. The second is that the decree creates new obligations for each affected EU company, but the guidance from the European Commission does not state that those new obligations that include the opening of new bank accounts could be in violation of the earlier arrangements between the parties under their gas supply contract. Finally, the document states that, to quote, it appears possible to pay for Russian gas under the decree without getting into conflict with EU law. And that's the most important message, I believe, and that could be a disappointing one for some of the buyers, because the guidance does not recommend that EU buyers refuse to pay in accordance with the procedure under the decree. Rather, the document only notes that the payment process, which would have been controlled by Russia, could potentially allow Russia to involve the Russian Central Bank, and that would have been prohibited under EU sanctions. But the new payment mechanism, as we see it now, and we do not know all particularities of that mechanism, does not involve Russian Central Bank. So the guidance as such, I would argue, does not in fact meaningfully discourage such payments in rubles. The guidance rather states that EU buyers are allowed to open the bank accounts in Gazprom Bank in accordance with the procedure stated in the decree. And it also suggests that it might be possible to pay for gas under the old terms.
So from a buyer's perspective, that's disappointing, because I guess they were hoping for some clear messages from the Commission about whether they should or should not go ahead with the mechanism proposed by the Kremlin. But do we then have any clarity on how EU buyers are now going to respond to that demand? What do we think about the way that buyers are now going to act?
I don't think that we have any more clarity that we had before. And EU buyers might have hoped for a solution from the European Commission, for an outcome of legal analysis, for a roadmap on how to respond to the demand to pay for gas in rubles. Instead, the guidance from the EU states what already features in the decree, which is that the EU buyers can apply for exemptions from the procedure under the decree. The process for applications for such exemptions is yet to be clarified, but that could be a potential way out from the new payment mechanism. But again, this is something what already features in the decree, and therefore the EU document does not propose any new solution. The document certainly does not submit any recommendation for a unified response from EU buyers, and the buyers are now indeed in the process of formulating their own response.
Okay, so we're left with a kind of, a disunified EU response and each company referring, I guess, to its own government and politicians to get some guidance as well. But I mean, one region that does seem to have made a sort of more concrete steps is the Baltics. And we've got recent headlines which have claimed that the Baltic states have become the first in Europe to stop Russian gas imports. Is that right? And does this kind of show us any pathway for the rest of Europe?
So the picture is a bit more nuanced because so far in the Baltic region, only Lithuania has stopped Russian gas imports. And it did so only for imports for domestic use, with gas still flowing to Kaliningrad under a long-term transit contract. Estonia seems ready to follow suit, with the government having reportedly agreed in principle to stop imports of Russian gas by the end of 2022. Latvia seemed least keen at the beginning to do so, but the government agreed last week to, quote, conceptually to quit Russian natural gas as of 1st January next year. And the next step for them will be to submit some proposals for the new law on the withdrawal from Russian gas imports. But it's still, I would say, an early stage for the discussion on that.
And can we draw any kind of conclusions or, you know, any relationship to the EU import reduction plans? Is there any learning to be had?
So the Baltic context involves very low import volumes when we look at the EU in general. But it's a very good example highlighting significant differences in the preparation of EU member states for import reductions. So we have Lithuania that has followed a consistent policy of reducing Russian gas imports over the years and prioritizing its LNG supplies, ending long-term contracts relatively early, not renewing it back in 2015. And placing emphasis on short-term one-year contracts. For Estonia, it's fairly similar in terms of favoring short-term contractual arrangements. The most complex situation is for Latvia, for sure, because there is a long-term contract that is running under 2030, and it's a take-or-pay agreement, and it might be simply difficult to terminate it or to find another way out from that agreement.
So what are the risks then in terms of breaching take-or-pay provisions for the Baltic states?
That's a very good question, because we keep discussing EU import reduction plans, and the discussion is heavily focused on securing alternative supply sources. But the overlooked issue in that discussion is, in my view, how to reduce volumes under the existing long-term contracts. Jack referred previously to flexibility in terms of daily nominations for any more severe import reductions in the long term. Take-or-pay obligations will come into play, and take-or-pay levels are set high in the EU. It is not unusual to see a contract where take-or-pay would exceed 80%. Now, the question will be how to mitigate the exposure of the buyers to any liability for breach of their contractual obligations. And there is certainly a significant gap between the plans for import reductions by two-thirds and the take-or-pay commitments under the contracts that are in operation.
And so do EU buyers have any right to renegotiate or terminate their contracts? What's the story there?
Also, those are another issues that are relevant here. There might not be any option to renegotiate the contract. There could be no contractual basis for that. Termination rights will feature in all of those agreements, but termination events tends to be a very short list, and the circumstances allowing the buyer to terminate the contract are expected to be of very extraordinary nature. So it might simply not be possible to terminate those contracts.
So in terms of then this, you know, any a potential EU ban on Russian gas imports, contractually and legally, that would be phenomenally difficult at the current stage.
So I would say this is an alternative course of action to the reduction of EU gas imports by 2/3, a much more severe measure that would require unity from EU member states. And this is, at this point, a rather unlikely outcome. Coming back to the beginning of our chat, I would also add that the tone of the guidance from the EU on the response to the ruble gas payment suggests that we are quite far from any EU import ban on Russian gas.
Okay, Agnieszka, look, thanks very much indeed for that. I guess we'll have to keep watching how buyers and individual countries within the EU respond to this guidance, which, as you say, has not exactly been definitive. So we'll keep an eye on that over future weeks. Thanks also to Jack and Mike for their contributions on Russian gas flows and prices and LNG. Please do continue to look out for our research, which is coming out regularly on our website. And another podcast like this one will be out next week. So with that, thank you very much indeed for listening. Take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.